Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm director of the Africa program here at CSIS. And we're delighted to have with us today Dr. Brian Brink of Anglo-American. I think many of you know Dr. Brink is senior vice president for health at Anglo-American. Anglo-American has been something of a pioneer on HIV/AIDS efforts, is currently the largest employer sponsor of free HIV/AIDS treatment in the world. It was one of the first as well. Dr. Brink has been engaged on HIV since the mid-80s and has led Anglo's efforts on the disease over that time, focused on healthcare benefits as well as on occupational health and community health issues. We're going to have a discussion today. I think we're going to keep it fairly informal, and Dr. Brink is going to talk about his experiences over those 20 years, talk a little bit about the trajectory of the pandemic in Southern Africa, perhaps a little bit about Anglo-American's experience. And I should say his experience extends beyond that of Anglo-American. The company itself has had many partnerships with community-based organizations trying to reach the communities better. He's been an advisor at the Nelson Mandela Foundation. He's an alternate board member for the private sector at the Global Fund. He's the current chair of the International Women's Health Coalition, and is also the director of Discovery Health, which is the largest health insurer in South Africa. And it would be interesting to hear a bit about that aspect as well. Wears many hats, has had a vast and long experience on HIV/AIDS, and I think at the end of his talk we'll offer perhaps some thoughts on the way forward, on the importance of keeping the attention on HIV/AIDS, particularly in a time when funding has become less abundant perhaps, and there are greater calls for focusing on some of the other health priorities and development priorities that are related, but not strictly HIV-focused. So Dr. Brink, you're most welcome here. We're going to keep it informal and have plenty of time at the end for comment and interaction and debate. So welcome.
Jennifer, thank you very much. It's great to be here and to share with you some of the experiences that I've learned over some 20 years or more dealing with HIV and AIDS at the epicenter of the epidemic, which is in Southern Africa. And I'm just going to pick out little bit highlights from my experience. I can't possibly hope to cover everything in 20 minutes. I hope that I will be able to explain to you how you get from Anglo-American to the International Women's Health Coalition in the course of this discussion. But if by the end of this talk you understand that, then I will have succeeded. But this is a subject which I am very passionate about. It's an epidemic in our part of the world that is having a devastating impact on society. And quite frankly, we are not making progress. And I hope today to try to bring up some thoughts as to why we aren't making progress. And what is it that we should be doing differently that could change the trajectory of this epidemic? And I suppose some people might take me to task in saying we're not making progress, but fortunately, there's recently been a national HIV prevalence survey done in South Africa. The results were released a couple of weeks ago. And this was a third in a series of these surveys. The first was done in 2002, then 2005, and the most recent one in 2008. And one thing that it has shown, when you look at the prevalence of HIV infection in people of South Africa over the age of 2, the prevalence has been relatively static at around 11% ever since 2002. Now, when you start delving into that, you might well ask, well, what's happening? does that mean that the new infections are slowing down? Or does it mean that the people who should be getting access to treatment and surviving are not getting it and are in fact dying? And I guess the truth probably is perhaps a little bit of both. But at 11% of the population, that's a huge proportion of the general population that is infected with HIV. What's a little bit more disturbing is when you dig a little bit deeper into that 11%, you find that when you look at the male population, it's 7.9%, and amongst the females, it's 13.6%. There's a huge disproportion between male and female. And one thing that I have seen in my years of experience dealing with HIV in Southern Africa is that the burden of this disease is borne by young women and girls. There is just no doubt, and the numbers are staggering. We get huge variation between provinces in South Africa. So if you look at KwaZulu-Natal in the general population, it's 16%. If you look at Western Cape, it's 4%. What has been encouraging is that the prevalence in children has gone down from 5.6% to 2.5%. And a lot of that, I think, is attributed to a successful program preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV. What's also quite encouraging is that the prevalence in youth, so 15 to 24, has also gone down from 10.3% to 8.6%. And when you start looking at HIV prevalence in teenagers, that actually becomes quite a good proxy for incidence. And so extrapolating sort of mathematically, what does seem to be happening and what's quite encouraging is that there seem to be fewer new infections in teenagers. So that's encouraging. At the same time, if you look at the female population at the prime of their childbearing age, which is 25 to 29, 1 in 3 females are HIV positive. 1 in 3. That's quite staggering. If you look at African females with a burden of disease, it actually becomes a wider age span from the age of 20 through to 34. That's also 1 in 3. 33% of all African women between the ages of 20 and 34 are HIV infected. That's a burden of disease which is huge. Looking at African men, and just by way of comparison, in the age group 25 right through to 49, the HIV prevalence there is 24%, about a quarter. Again, it just highlights this huge discrepancy, which is one of the things that really has to be tackled. Other interesting things out of the survey, just in passing, are that it seems that condom use has improved. It's gone up from 31% to 65%. There's a lot of high condom use amongst young people, even up to 80%. And it's encouraging that HIV prevention communication is reaching 90% of young people. That's encouraging. One of the huge concerns coming out of this recent survey is that there's a lot of intergenerational sex. And this is older men having sex with young women and girls, young girls. Another encouraging thing is that more and more people are having HIV tests. So around a half of all of those over the age of 15 have ever had an HIV test, which is a figure which is significantly higher than what's usually given out. There again, there's a little subset to that. The women come for testing much more frequently than the men. And that, again, is a pattern of our experience. In Southern Africa, women are prepared to come forward and to deal with the issues. The men seem to constantly want to hide away. Only 25% of people have had an HIV test in the last 12 months. But when I give you all those figures, I think for me, it's fair to say that the response is not working. And that then brings us to a much bigger debate. What should we be doing? And I draw on my workplace experience for that, because when I first started dealing with HIV in the mid-80s, there was no HIV in our mining workforce. And slowly but surely over the years, it progressed right up to a stage when perhaps 25% of the workforce was HIV infected. And in those early years, in the 90s, it was just despairing to try and work with HIV. There was nothing that we could do that made any difference. There was a huge turning point, which was the advent of treatment, which for us was in 2002. We made a policy decision that we would provide free access to AIDS treatment for all our employees. And at the time, it was a big decision to make. It was a big leap of faith into the unknown. But it really was quite transformative. And of course, to get treated for HIV, you first actually have to diagnose it. So the entry point for all of our programs became HIV testing. And in 2002, less than 10% of our workforce had ever had an HIV test. We've pushed very hard on testing. And from less than 10%, we've now reached a stage where over 75% of our workforce test for HIV every year. Every year. And they do that voluntarily. Why do they do it? I believe very firmly that the reason is the foundation of our AIDS response, which is a human rights foundation. We start by guaranteeing the rights of all our employees. We guarantee that there will be no prejudice against anyone with HIV infection. No discrimination. We will work constantly to remove stigma. People with HIV are treated just like any other employee in absolutely every respect of their employment. So they get full access to full healthcare benefits. They get the same access to life insurance as all our other employees. They get the same training. They get the same promotion opportunities. HIV is simply not a factor when it comes to workplace advancement. What people with HIV do get is the benefit of free access to care and support and treatment. And over the years, I think our employees have got to know that and to understand it. And because of that, there is no fear anymore. And the stigma basically has dissolved away. People know today that you live with HIV, you don't die from it. And the treatment has been extraordinarily effective. It really is. And I will talk more about that just now, but what has really become important for us is there is a huge cost to treatment. In the workplace, we can offset a lot of those costs by savings, in that employees are no longer absent from work because they're sick. We don't incur other healthcare costs. We don't lose employees and have to pay pension benefits to dependents. We don't have to recruit new employees from employees that were lost. So we have full savings. And in fact, when we look on an individual basis, the savings that we get out of the treatment program actually outweigh the costs of providing that treatment at an individual level. One consequence, though, is at a company level, you have more and more people living with HIV. And so at a company level, this burden of providing the treatment just keeps on growing. And so there still ends up being a net cost to the company overall. And for that, we realized that if we want to sustain our treatment interventions, there is only one solution. We have to get a whole lot better at our prevention. And so that's what occupies our minds more than anything else right now, is how can we be better at prevention? And why have we not succeeded in reducing these new infections. The first challenge that we had was, well, how many new infections are we getting? What is the incidence? And we rapidly realized when we've been measuring prevalence all these years, we've been measuring the wrong thing. That if you actually want to deal with HIV effectively, you have to get to measure incidence. And I think this is a problem which is bedeviling the whole world, is how can you more accurately measure the incidence of new infections, because that becomes the benchmark of success for your prevention program. What we have found is in our workplaces that are implementing better than anywhere else is where we have successive HIV testing year on year and almost the entire population gets tested. We know people's HIV status 1 year, and the next year we know who's converted from negative to positive. We can actually measure those new infections. So in Anglo Coal, who have a particularly good program within Anglo American, they can tell you day by day how many new HIV infections they've got. They know, for example, this year they have had 35 new infections. They know that there are another, and I can't remember the exact figure, but another 20-odd of people who hadn't previously tested who are also HIV positive. But all in all, there are 55 new people that have to come into the AIDS or the HIV care program. But they, in measuring that incidence of new infections, they last year they got a figure of 1.4% new infections. And that kind of doesn't sound to be so much, but if you take 1.4% of the population of South Africa, that's 500,000 new HIV infections a year. And so 1.4% is a huge number of new infections. And the compounding effect of that over time is intolerable. So we are striving, in fact, we have set a target for new infections of zero, because that's where we have to go. And a lot of people tend to ridicule me when I say zero new HIV infections. But if we don't start thinking like that, we're actually never going to stop HIV. You have to think zero. And every single new infection is a failure of your prevention program. And we have to start measuring. And to measure, you've got to take a population-based approach to your prevention program. You can't just deal with numerators, the people that come through the door. You've actually got to define the population, and you've got to intervene with a prevention response which is targeted at the entire population. And for us at Anglo, when we think about why are we not succeeding, the first thing that comes straight at us in our faces is, well, what have you been doing about the dependents? You're treating the employees really successfully, but that's only half the deal. What about the dependents? And so, with huge confidence, last year we changed our policy to extend the same level of benefits and access to care and support and treatment to the dependents of all our employees. And that one we know. There's no financial return on that, other than it's a contribution to stopping the epidemic. And it's going to be a long haul to get to all those dependents, because for those of you who know mining in South Africa, we have quite, excuse me, we have significant numbers of migrant workers. It's actually a feature of developing countries that work is often not where the family lives. And dealing with those issues where the family is living in a rural area and the employees working more closer to an urban area is just one of the things that we have to deal with. So getting to families for us means actually moving right out into the communities. And not just the communities around the mines, but actually the communities in quite deep rural areas where the access to services is, as you can imagine, is a lot less than it should be. And so we spend a lot of time looking at, well, how can we intervene in these rural communities to find ways in which we can strengthen this response to AIDS. And when you look at really weak health services, the first place that you end up is saying that you've got to strengthen the health system. You've just got to get it to function better. And if the health system is not functioning, your AIDS response is, your HIV prevention response is just not going to work. And I guess this is probably a common cause to a lot of people, but through our experience, we believe this absolutely implicitly, that our prevention response has to address the strengthening of the health system. And we've got to find smart ways to start doing that within communities. I want to just touch on a couple of my little hobby horses. One of them is around HIV testing. We have contrived to make HIV testing as difficult to get as is humanly possible. We have insisted, before we used to take blood and we used to send it away and people didn't get their results, we moved to rapid testing. We now do finger pricks and it's a blood-based test. One of the things that we found at Anglo-American is we use oral swabs. This test is so quick and so easy to do. You scrape around in the mouth, and you have a little vial of fluid, and you put it in, and 10 minutes later, you've got the answer. And this is as accurate as any other kind of test. They're all over 99%. It is so quick and so easy and so non-invasive to get an HIV test. And when I'm finished with this thing, I can just throw it away because there's no blood. I don't need a trained healthcare worker. I don't have sharps to dispose of. All of those issues. I just get the test done and throw it away. I can have a lay trained counselor test with this and get the results. We have to scale up the HIV testing hugely, hugely. And we have to repeat it. It's no good just to one-off test and say that's done. I, in fact, like to talk about enrolling the population in the fight against AIDS, and you enroll with an HIV test. And when you've had that first HIV test, you go along two paths. You're either HIV positive or you're HIV negative. If you're HIV positive, the very next step is enter the program of care and support, get your CD4 count, and decide if and when you need treatment, and get engaged in positive prevention. If you're HIV negative, you also get engaged in ensuring that you stay HIV negative until the time of the next test. So for me, every single person that tests actually gets enrolled in a program, because I'm just as interested in making sure that the person who was negative is negative next time around. And so for me, there's actually no discrimination left in testing. Everybody's in the program. Just need to get the testing done, and we need to make it quick and easy. This test costs 4 times more than the finger stick test. We somehow think in developing countries that if something's more expensive, we can't use it. We'll rather stick with the test that's the cheapest test you can get. It's not cheaper, because you now have to have professional staff that cost a lot more. It takes more time. You've got increased risks to healthcare workers. You add all that up, and it turns out to be more expensive. But nobody will buy a test like this because they say, oh, it's too expensive. And I just can't understand that. We certainly at Anglo-American use those tests, and it has made a huge difference to people testing. The other hobby horse I have is treatment, access to treatment, and when to provide the treatment. And I just have to say, on treatment, we've done too little, too late. That it's as simple as that. We have policies, certainly in our country, the policy at the moment is that treatment will not be started until the CD4 count drops below 200. In other words, we will wait until you have full-blown AIDS before we provide you access to treatment, on the basis that we're going to save money. It's bizarre, because once you descend to a stage where you've got AIDS below 200, chances are you've got TB. And what we end up is whenever we start to treat patients with CD4s below 200, we have to end up treating both TB and AIDS together. It's much more complicated, it's much more expensive, it's much more dangerous, and the outcomes are much worse. Yet we have a policy position that says we're going to save money by holding on as long as we can before we start the treatment. It makes no economic sense whatsoever. In fact, if you're putting somebody on ARVs, you're going to be doing that for the next 30 years. What difference is 1 year going to make in that treatment? But we rather wait till people get sick before we start treatment. That is just crazy. You wait for them to spread the infection more. You wait for the viral load to go up to levels at which it really becomes dangerous. It's just crazy. So we need rapidly to move to starting treatment earlier. We certainly in our company start treatment when the CD4 has reached 350. But there's a lot of discussion now about test to treat. If somebody's HIV positive, start talking about treatment straight away, because that's in the end where you're going to end up. And that's the way you have to go. The 200 is a policy, which I think there's a fear to change because of cost. It's not that people don't recognize the benefits of earlier access to treatment. They're worried about the cost. We have shown on this cost side quite conclusively that at an individual level that the cost of providing treatment is more than covered by the benefits that you achieve through that treatment. And I just think for a country as a whole, if we treat people before they get sick, we will reduce the burden of TB, and the TB epidemic is exploding, absolutely exploding. And all the problems that go with that, and drug-resistant TB, and extremely drug-resistant, and so on. So TB and HIV have just become synonymous with each other. And if we would certainly impact on the TB epidemic and bring it down. And the cost to the country of reducing this burden of disease, I believe at the moment the burden as it stands today must be dragging our GDP down, I think, by at least 2% per annum. And if we could simply deal with that burden, that would be the return. We free people up to get on with their economic activity and take away the burden of disease. So much as we feel that we can't do it, we actually have no choice but to get on and do as much treatment as we possibly can. There's no backing out of that. If we back out of that, and of course it's become a very pertinent discussion now because of the economic recession. There's a funding crisis. The money's run out. And people are saying, well, how can we limit the number of people that get access to treatment? There's only one way that you can limit that: by stopping the new infections. And that's where we have to rededicate ourselves. But if we slow down on doing the treatment, we're on a road to nowhere. And once on treatment, there's another one of my hobby horses. What pills are you going to give someone to treat them? There's a notion in the developing world that you must use the cheapest pills that you can buy. That's what generally gets used. The cheapest pills are the pills are the drugs that were developed early that have the most side effects. The patients aren't stupid. They know that once they've been on these pills for a certain period of time, they start developing the side effects. They get lipodystrophy. They get neuropathy, pain in the hands and the feet and whatever. Guess what they do when those side effects start appearing? They stop taking the treatment. So our adherence becomes poor. We give them a pill burden, which is difficult to manage. My own experience of trying to take pills over a long time is that I'm hopeless at it. It's just the fewer the better. Good AIDS treatment today comes down to one pill once a day. Costs a bit more to get those drugs, which are much more effective, have far fewer side effects. In the long term, that simple regimen is much more likely to lead to long-term adherence than what we do at the moment. But again, for some bizarre reason, we simply insist on giving the cheapest that money can buy, in the notion that we're making some kind of saving. We're not. And the adherence figures, in my experience, on ART are dismal. The dropout rates typically, it depends how long you've been at it, but you know, for an average length of time that people have been on treatment, the dropout rates are about a third of all those that are on treatment, and sometimes even higher than that. We have to redefine care for people that are getting treatment. And it's no good to say somebody missed their appointment. We were waiting for them, and they didn't pitch up. We need to reach a stage when we know the day that somebody misses their treatment is the day that we intervene to support them and get them back onto treatment. We've got to find ways to do that. And there's lots of promising technology with cell phones and all kinds of things. But we have to redefine that care. And non-adherence to treatment is just not acceptable. We've got to find ways to make that happen much better. I want to come back. So I've pushed the treatment very hard, and it does, it's miraculous. It really is miraculous to see people saved on this treatment. And I love it, and I will defend treatment all the way. But I just know that the world cannot afford to do all this treatment unless we succeed in prevention. So through treatment, I come straight back to prevention. And we have to ask ourselves some really, really hard questions as to why we are not succeeding in our prevention efforts. And the one that I'm afraid springs out most to me is the position of young women and girls. I simply look at that monstrous disproportion in the burden of infection between young women and young men. And it says something to me. HIV has simply exposed a deficit in our society which we've tolerated over generations. It's the status of women in society, the state of empowerment of women within society, the extent to which women are able to realize their fundamental human rights. And if we don't get that right, we are simply never going to stop the spread of HIV. And so when I'm asked where do I want to intervene first and foremost, that's the place where we have to do it. We have to find ways in which we can empower young women and girls and protect them from the ravages of HIV infection. And that means investing in reproductive rights and reproductive health services. And I'm always told by my colleagues at the International Women's Health Coalition, the rights come before the health. And don't ever forget that. And that's what we have to get right. My concern is when I talk about reproductive health services, everybody seems to have a different interpretation of what that means. And I'm led to believe that in this country, if you say that, it's code for abortion. And it's that's so far from the truth that it's ridiculous. The one thing that we really have to do, first and foremost, is get to adolescents, both boys and girls, with comprehensive sexuality education. We have to inform them and empower them how to deal with their sexual relationships. They need accurate information. They need to understand about gender equality. They need to understand about nonviolence. They need to understand about human rights. And that has to start from the age of 11. And if I was to look for the one single most important program that I think will make a difference, that would be it. Moving on into other reproductive health services, there's family planning. There's access to condoms, both male and female. When you look at the number of female condoms available in developing countries, hard to find, really hard to find. Speak to the men and they say, oh, don't worry about that. Speak to the women and the women say, yes, we would very much like to have something which we can use to protect ourselves. So that's a big thing. Then there's just basic maternal health services, antenatal care, essential obstetric care. When you go out into rural areas and you visit clinics and you find the health services that are there specifically for women, they are non-existent. Non-existent. Complications in pregnancy are discovered at the time of labor, or often too late, and it either translates into infant mortality, maternal mortality, or maternal injury which disables those mothers lifelong. And we simply have to do better. The investments in health services for women in developing countries at primary care level are abysmal. Cancer of the cervix is hugely prevalent within our communities, and with HIV, we are seeing more than ever. The ability to simply to diagnose and treat early doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. Sexually transmitted infections don't get diagnosed in women simply because the physical facilities and equipment you need to do that aren't there. The best women can hope for is presumptive treatment for sexually transmitted infections. That's hopeless. That's just shirking out of doing the job properly. And if those sexually transmitted infections are there and are undiagnosed and untreated, you create a portal of entry for HIV. And I think that the burden of STIs is huge in some of these communities. And yes, safe abortion services are part of the reproductive health services that are needed. And you only have to work in a developing country to see the unsafe abortions that take place and the damage that is done from those to realize that you're talking about providing safety for women, giving them the right to make the choice for themselves and respecting each and every individual's personal choice. That certainly is something that one has to do. The final point that I'd want to make, and I've probably gone on too long, Jennifer, is that it's not just up to government to deal with this epidemic. The only way we're ever going to get it done is through partnership. And it's government, it's the private sector, business, and it's civil society. Some of the most amazing work has been done by civil society. And in fact, if we can find ways and means to partner, we can actually mount a response where in fact, we can make the difference. And I actually am very hopeful that we can turn the AIDS epidemic around. I like to talk about three zeros, that there will be zero new HIV infections in whichever population we choose, that there will be zero people that get sick or die from HIV or from AIDS. That shouldn't happen anymore. And that there should be zero babies born HIV positive. All those three are achievable. And if you think about it and you get your mind thinking that way, you achieve those three things, you've stopped the AIDS epidemic. And the only final qualifier is whatever your response is going to be, make sure that it's based on a human rights foundation and you will succeed. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you very much. Gosh, thank you. That was a very full presentation. I will open it up for questions and discussions. the costs of this, I mean, we're talking now, particularly in the U.S. and the donor community, of real resource constraints, I think. And when you talk of kind of the cumulative burden of HIV treatment, when you talk about health system strengthening, when you talk about interventions in education, and it's hard to think that there don't have to be some kinds of trade-offs in some ways, or are there things that we simply can be doing more efficiently? You do ultimately...
The cost is huge. We would be much better off without HIV. But the fact is, it's there. And the question is now how best to respond. And certainly in our business, the cost of no response, we know, will be considerably more than the cost of a good response. A good response, we are absolutely confident. I mean, we were, as a business, threatened by HIV 10 years ago. Investors were looking and saying, they operate in Africa. They, you know, that's not the kind of business that we feel safe to invest in. Today, that fear has gone completely. And it's simply based on a comprehensive program, which we know we can afford. Mm-hmm. The better we do the program, the more sustainable it is. But, you know, the only qualifier is we've got to come back to prevention. If we don't succeed in stopping those new infections, and that's why we actually need to tackle it as if we're going to war. We need a campaign on stopping those new infections. And I just think we've been too soft on it. We've got to get much more aggressive on that. And I can't think of a way to reduce costs in the short term without compromising the long-term outcome. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to sustain our current level of expenditure, perhaps even do more, knowing that in the future it will come down if we do it properly. So yes, we have to be efficient, and so we have to diagnose early, we have to treat early, we have to ensure adherence. We've got to be smart about the way we do it. And I think there are a lot of inefficiencies in the system which need ironing out. But I'm afraid we've got to be bold.
Thank you. Let's take some questions. Yes, sir. And if you could introduce yourself.
Sure, yeah. Jim Shelton, USAID. I'm an epidemiologist. And very interesting listening to you because what you're addressing in many ways is a microcosm of what the whole field is doing. So hats off to you for bringing a guest that could do that. And I like the emphasis on prevention because that's largely what I do.
I'm a closet epidemiologist.
One of the things that all did not change also on the three surveys, including the 2008 survey that I don't think you mentioned, was numbers of people saying they had multiple sexual partners. Mm-hmm. And in a heterosexual epidemic, basically, just not to oversimplify too much, there have to be a fair number of people having multiple partners. And unlike other countries actually in the region, notably more recently Kenya and Zimbabwe, where numbers of partners has decreased concomitant with declines in HIV incidence, that has just not happened in South Africa. So I'm just wondering if that's a key part of your program.
Yeah.
You just happened not to mention it.
No,
okay,
I just happened not to mention it. I've got another set of papers here, and it's written down there.
Well, just one thing to clarify. I do think...
Multiple concurrent partners is certainly one of these.
I do think reaching out to the dependents, as you call them, is really a key part of that sort of... Because you do have... Concurrent partners actually requires you to sort of talk to the partners of your employees as well to sort of deal with it properly.
We were challenged to develop an appropriate definition for dependent in terms of this policy. And we actually have a very broad-based, which includes obviously a spouse, but it also includes any partner in a relationship that's a long-term relationship of mutual dependency. We don't require marriage, and we will accept multiple partners, because I'm afraid it's a fact of life. What we do want to do is try to get to all the people concerned. And I couldn't agree with you more. We've got to reduce those numbers of concurrent partners, but we have to make sure that every sexual encounter is at least safe.
Dave, Janet,
Hi, David Heineck with the CSIS Africa Program. Dr. Brown, can you talk about your experiences in basically your interactions with other companies as well as civil society in forming some of the types of partnerships that you've talked about? Basically, I'm trying to get a sense of what other companies on the ground, how they're viewing the Anglo-American model. Are they listening to it? Are you interacting with them? Are they coming to you to see your experiences?
I've always believed very strongly in the coalition concept in terms of the business response to AIDS. And we have business coalitions. So at the international level, we have the Global Business Coalition on HIV and AIDS. They've added TB and malaria now to the scope. But that grouping, and they're actually meeting now in Washington over this week, actually tries to highlight all those companies that are involved and making a contribution towards fighting this epidemic. I so often get asked, what will we get out of belonging to the business coalition? And to paraphrase a famous quote, I say, don't ask yourselves what you're going to get out of it, ask yourselves what you're going to put into it. Because it's this coalition of businesses that actually can make the difference. HIV is an infection which it has a predilection for working people of working age. What better place than to actually start dealing with the response to AIDS? So I think business has a huge responsibility. And there have been companies out there that have got marvelous programs. I'm sure there are plenty out there that have better programs than ours. Everyone is different. They all have different features. There's huge innovation. By getting together and talking about it and by building support bases, I think we just strengthen that response from business. The sad thing is that there are just not enough companies involved. So in the GBC, I think they have a core membership of some 200 big international companies, but there should be many, many more that actually understand that this is an important part of sustainable business development. Most international businesses are looking to developing countries as emerging markets. Those will not be good markets if they're sick. So if business makes an investment in health, I think that there will, in the long term, be a return from that investment. It's part of sustainable development. I think it's just as important as dealing with environmental issues, dealing with global health issues. So getting businesses enrolled, and in every country there tends to be a local business coalition. It's sadly, it seems to be the big businesses that get in there. I think the real challenge is the small and medium enterprises. But they often tell us that they can't afford to mount a good HIV response. And my reply is that you can't afford not to. As a small business, you can't afford to lose your employees to illness. You can't afford to lose those vital skills which keep your business going. So your investment in responding to AIDS will actually sustain your business.
Thank you very much. My name is Janet Fleischman. I've done a lot of work on gender and AIDS for the CSIS AIDS Task Force, and was very interested to hear your comments and your powerful comments about the burden on young women and girls and the importance of comprehensive sexuality education. I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about other interventions that you're aware of in the region that are trying to look at that angle of prevention and mitigation to address those human rights and gender dynamics that are putting women and girls at risk or increasing their likelihood of engaging in risky behaviors, including multiple partnerships, so that we can begin to get at the root of why these new infections among women and girls are continuing at the pace they are.
Actually, in South Africa, we've got some quite good organizations that often have been subjected to certain degrees of criticism. So there's some big well-known campaigns. One of them is Soul City, which seems to have had enduring support from all quarters. Another was Love Life, which has its supporters and has its detractors. The fact is that both of these campaigns were directed primarily at young people and engaged at a level which embraced comprehensive sexuality education. it's interesting to see that in this new survey that there seems to be some results coming out for young people, for teenagers, and that maybe it is the nature of those programs that is making the difference. There's a government program called Komanani, which didn't seem to be getting to the people that it should be getting to. And so I think we've reached a very interesting stage in this debate. My concern has always been, and I've only named a couple, there are many others, that a lot of these initiatives are happening, but somehow we don't seem to be able to pull them all together into something that will have a broader impact. And I think there's a huge need right now to do exactly that, to find a way that all these good programs can be brought together in a way where each can learn from the other, and we can document the good practices. We can start training up many more people with the requisite skills, and we can get these programs out more effectively to more and more young people. And I do think that they will make a difference. So, again, you know, we have to be bold in pursuing those programs. And up to now, I think we've been perhaps a little half-hearted in that. And I do know that many of these programs struggle to get funding. And a lot of these programs are often based around gender equity, gender equality, human rights. I'm always amazed that it seems difficult to find funding to support human rights-based initiatives. That I find incredible.
Let me turn to Steve, but can I ask you first, building on Dave's question, from whom does Anglo purchase its drugs? Has it negotiated discounts in that, and is there a way, I mean, particularly for the small and medium-sized enterprises, the purchase of the drugs and procuring them would be a challenge, but if there's a coalition that negotiates across the board?
When we first started out, we negotiated with some of the big pharma companies and
got
written contracts, but we basically were afforded what is called access pricing initiatives for developing countries, where the drugs were at prices that were a fifth or even a tenth of the prices that these drugs were being sold around the world. And to this day, the pricing in developing countries is still way less than it would be in developed countries. In South Africa, we have a thing now called a single exit price for all drugs. And by law, there can be no discounting. So the drugs are the same price for everybody, except the government, who seem to have reserved to themselves the right to tender and get special discounts for government. And I can't comprehend that. I think if we're going to have one price for all drugs, let's have one price for all drugs and let the private sector get access to the same preferential pricing that the government sector gets.
In fact, you might even, I mean, if there's a greater demand, it might drive the price down.
The big issue, as I understand it, with the drug companies is just give them sensible forecasting so that they can plan the manufacturing in a way that allows them to cut cost. And there are all kinds of elements to the cost of producing the drugs. If we were to work together, we would actually find solutions that bring prices down. No doubt about that. But somehow we don't get it together. And prices continue to be higher than they need to be. I still think that we're getting pretty good prices for our AIDS drugs. And when I compare those drugs to, say, drugs for asthma or diabetes or hypertension or epilepsy, we're getting pretty good deals.
Steve.
Thank you, Brian, for that presentation. Just a quick comment about South Africa and where it sits in U.S. strategy, and then a question to you about what may lie ahead. I mean, you could make a case that the U.S. investment in global health in South Africa is arguably the biggest and most dramatic test case of whether this is going to be effective or not. I mean, just the scale of dollars going in under PEPFAR is extraordinary. And so if it works there, you know, if it doesn't work there, it's going to have great implications. And the administration has already signaled that it's leaning in some of the directions that you're indicating in terms of a commitment to really look seriously at maternal and child health, family planning, renew efforts around prevention. But when you step back for a moment on the South Africa relationship, our bilateral relationship deteriorated significantly between Washington and South Africa over the last several years, even while we moved to this rather amazing commitment in dollar terms and ambitions around health, our bilateral relationship deteriorated to a very significant degree. And now we're at a moment where you've got two new governments in place, really, and you have an opportunity to sort of revisit some of this. And hopefully that will get us onto another footing looking forward. So my question really is, what can we anticipate from the new government in South Africa on these health issues? Are we going to see some significant change in policy and practice and attitude and engagement? Obviously, there's a lot of dysfunctionality that has to be unwound in terms of the Mbeki inheritance, and that's not going to happen overnight. But can you share with us a bit about what you think is a realistic, hopeful sort of projection looking forward on what might be unfolding in this next period on the health agenda? Because it's going to be front and center. Is if we get into a renewed bilateral relationship, which I think we will, it's going to be one of the central dimensions of that, points of discussion. And any other practical issues you have around how we might structure that dialogue looking forward. In the past, when apartheid ended, we created a special, Gore and Mbeki structure. I'm not sure we're going to do that again, although we had a Gore Chernomyrdin, and the president's going to Russia in another 10 days, and there's going to be a discussion around renewing that relationship, much like we might see a discussion around renewing the South African relationship.
Steve, I think from government, we have had signals of complete change. I would almost say like a 180-degree turnaround in terms of wanting to engage, wanting to partner, wanting to do the right things. We were certainly engaged with the previous Minister of Health, Barbara Hogan. She was cool, calm, logical about the whole thing, and had done really good analysis and was setting out on doing all the right things. And we're hugely supportive of that and had meetings set up to discuss, how can we as a business contribute? What's our part in all of this? We've since had an election and we've had a change of Minister of Health. And sadly, I guess we've got to start again. But I haven't seen any change in the signals. I think that the new Minister of Health is wanting to continue the same work that Barbara Hogan started. So I think it's early days, but I am very optimistic that there are going to be huge opportunities for engagement on a basis of partnership. And I'm very encouraged in President Zuma's State of the Nation address to Parliament. He talked about public-private partnerships in the response to AIDS. And I take that as an absolute commitment that's where government wants to go. And I see U.S. donor money as government money. We need our own government money from South Africa, and we need private money. And we're going to have to get very innovative about scaling up the resources that are available to deal with this epidemic. But I also think that within South Africa, in terms of the rest of Africa, we have enormous resources. We have no excuse to not have a leading response to AIDS. I think we do have the capacity, and we just need to get organized and get going. And I would hope that the U.S. and other international donors would all be part of a bigger and much more strategic response to AIDS where everybody's bought into it and we all take our piece and deal with it. in a sort of common framework. And I think the beginnings of all of that are there. But I think it's up to us to make it work. And there again, I think that businesses can be very influential within country, alongside of government. And, you know, in many respects, that's why I sort of take the time out to come and talk to talk here, because I think this is a voice that everybody needs to understand and be part of. I sit on the Global Fund now as the board member for the private sector, and there are multiple donors in that forum, and huge questions about how to spend that money most effectively. But that's part of the global response to dealing with this burden of disease, which we just have to get right. And we want to contribute to that.
I'm Jeff Sturgill. I'm the chairman of the Corporate Council on Africa, and in a couple of weeks I'll be the president and CEO of the Global Health Council. Brian, I just wanted to come back in another way to the question that Steve posed. You gave us a very compelling survey of all the priorities in dealing with the HIV epidemic in South Africa and Southern Africa. You talked equally compellingly about the important role of partnerships. And now in the last few minutes, we've finally gotten to the third P, which is politics, because I think in the end, certainly in South Africa, that has a lot to do with what's really possible. And with the new government, I think there's an opportunity, and I just wondered if you'd comment on this. When you were talking earlier about how there aren't enough companies involved, even though partnerships with the private sector probably do offer an important way forward, one thing that occurred to me is whether in South Africa there's been any exploration of incentives for those kinds of partnerships. I mean, all too often, public-private partnerships are government decides what to do and then taxes companies to provide the money to do it. So that's one definition of partnership. Obviously, from the private sector side, there's a slightly different impression of what the roles and responsibilities should be. But I wonder if there were tax incentives that were in place to encourage companies to implement health initiatives, then even small and medium enterprises would have a way to get involved, and that might actually be a way to tap the much greater resources available in the private sector to address some of these questions. And then a related comment is whether you think there might be an opportunity with Trevor Manuel's new role in this new national planning ministry to look at that as a possible answer in the context of really thinking broadly about what's required to scale up the response to the epidemic. Because I think you're absolutely right that there's been a short-term emphasis on just trying to find the resources to implement treatment. But there are really much larger questions around where the resources will come from to have a fully competent long-term response to the epidemic.
Thanks, Jeff. I don't think you've shed your private sector mantle completely yet. I think we would absolutely support any structure based on incentives. That's the way to get things going. And certainly when it comes to taxation, I actually start by saying, please don't tax the response to AIDS, which is what we do at the moment. So that should be a fairly easy thing to take away. And then moving beyond that, to create incentives, but for me, those incentives need to be based on the notion of partnership and co-investment. And so I'm certainly been working on the idea of a health insurance proposal for AIDS, which could be based on a one-third, one-third, one-third funding ratio, where if an employer would put in one-third, government could put in one-third, and donors could put in one-third. For every one of those contributors, it's a good deal. You're putting in one-third, and two-thirds is coming from somewhere else, and you're getting the job done. That I think is the kind of partnership that we should be exploring. So co-investment for me could create incentives, which would have significant benefits. And I would hope that Trevor Manuel, who's a very accomplished person in the realm of finance and has done a lot for South Africa in his new role, because you know we're looking for innovation, we're looking for creativity. I think it would be the ideal sort of thing for him to be tackling.
Hazel Denton Seiss. I was very interested in the way you circled back after all the different initiatives to prevention and especially condom use. And I wondered if you could elaborate a little more on the condom policy in South Africa in general. What I'm thinking of is that if you're a youth in a low-income area, are condoms readily available? Are they visible? Is the price right? Is it free or subsidized? You know, how much is that emphasis there? Is it dependent on donors? I'm just thinking, are there lessons that we might learn perhaps for our own city here in Washington where we certainly have problems?
Certainly in South Africa, the policies there, which makes condoms, and now particularly I'm talking about male condoms, available and accessible on as wide a front as possible in as many locations as possible, and significant money does go into that. Free, absolutely free. I think it just comes to the implementation, and it's the depth of the implementation where you actually get down to community, and in a particular community you've actually got to look and see what is the specific availability of condoms. And whenever you look at the actual numbers of condoms dispensed, as it were, those numbers fall far short of what the potential number of sexual encounters is. So I think we've got a long way to go in this whole accessibility thing. But it's more about getting good plans in place at a local level to make sure that they are consistently available at the right time. And I know how much hard work that is, because at Anglo American we have a condom policy which makes both male and female condoms readily available to all employees. But there still come times when I will go in a restroom and you will find that the condom dispense is empty. And, you know, I track, in fact, on a monthly basis, the exact numbers of condoms, and I want to see it going up all the time. So you've actually got to put in management to make sure that it happens. And then having said that, our performance on female condoms is dismal, absolutely hopeless. And we need to do a lot better on that, much improved accessibility. And we need a better female condom. And there are prototypes out there. I know PATH is developing one. There's some really good new prototypes. And we shouldn't hide behind and just say, oh, well, it's not a particularly user-friendly technology. I think we find ways to do it better. And we need to invest much more money into female condoms.
Hi, my name is Hannah. I actually spent 4 years in South Africa working on HIV/AIDS, so thank you. I really appreciate your comments. I feel like you are very lucid in your ideas and the complexities of this epidemic and what needs to happen, and almost, you know, you've done a very good job of almost simplifying it, talking about how it's, you know, the affordability or almost how essential it is to provide treatment and, you know, dealing with gender at a very young age, sexuality and gender at a young age, how important condoms are in prevention. Can you talk a little bit about why everything that you know is not sort of being put into practice? Like, what is missing? I mean, it seems like you get it. You understand what the problems are and why are they not being used. What is, like, missing in that implementation? Or is it political will? Is it money? Is it sex? I mean, what? I don't know. Yeah.
If I try and bring it down to one thing that's missing, based on experience within our business, I would say it's leadership. In the companies that I've seen that have good responses, you invariably find that the CEO is personally involved, understands the issues, and drives it. And that is my expectation of all the Anglo-American businesses now. And you go to any of our CEOs and you talk about VCT and ARVs and all of these things, they know what you're talking about. They understand the issues, but they have to do more than that. They actually have to drive it. And what comes after that leadership, it's management. You really have to have effective management. And management is not that easy, because that's about getting good policies implemented. I think in South Africa we have a way of producing good policy. We have some of the best AIDS legislation in the world. But actually getting it implemented is the challenge. If the leadership is missing, it's not ever going to happen. And we've had a weakness in leadership. And I'm looking to see now that we're going to get strong leadership. And I think that on its own will make a huge difference. Beyond that, we do have to improve management. And I think that's a contribution that the private sector can help with. We pride ourselves on our management skills. We think that's what differentiates good companies from bad ones. And so we should be able to lend a helping hand on management issues.
Merson, who we've met by phone. I happen to be in the building today at PATH, for a meeting we're having on the AIDS 2031 initiative. We're at the final stage. We're one of the 9 groups dealing with science and technology, and we have to get our report in a month. And the interesting question we're debating upstairs, which I'd love you to comment on, is that in a world where it's likely there'll be a decrease in AIDS funding for the next who knows how many years, where they're competing whether the economic situation or competing priorities in global health, we can come up with a number of reasons why it's likely. And what I'm hearing upstairs, it's not just in the United States. My colleagues in Europe are saying the same thing. The same questions are being asked in Europe now that are being asked here in terms of the relative priority that should be given to AIDS. So if we take that context, what we're trying to do in the AIDS 2031 initiative is ask, what are the few things that we ought to be doing right now so that by AIDS 2031, which is the 50th anniversary of the pandemic, AIDS wouldn't be a problem. And so you can imagine there's a group of people arguing for PrEP, even though there's a lot of doubts about PrEP, and there are people that want to shoot for the cure, and there are people that want to put all the money into vaccine, and there are people who think it should be all into diagnostic tests. You know, you have your different camps. So where you sit, I'm just interested, if you had to pick one or two things in a declining resource environment globally, what you would really think would make the difference in South Africa, particularly in Southern Africa, where the epidemic has been the most severe. I don't know if you want to just comment, but it seems to me that these are really burning questions in terms of resource allocations globally in the next few years.
I once went to a workshop with the Gates Foundation, and strangely enough, they asked the same question, but a slightly different way. They said, if you had only $1 million to invest in a particular response to AIDS, where would you focus that money? And at that time, my answer to that question was I would invest it in reproductive health services for women and girls. And that was my answer in a really resource-constrained environment. And I've had no reason to change my mind on that. Having said that, I hope we don't end up in just being like that. I think it's an impossible question that you'll face, but I do know where our investments have been hugely deficient, and I do know that the kinds of investments that are required there are actually not that great. That it's stunning that those investments have not been made. And the logic of it is that it comes back to prevention, and we really have to stop those new infections. And I just look at the numbers, and I look at the burden of disease in young women in sub-Saharan Africa. It's different here in the U.S., perhaps, South America, you're seeing increasing feminization of the AIDS epidemic. I think it's going to happen all over the world. We just happen to have it right now where we are. That's where I would focus the money.
Particularly in the context of perhaps resource allocation, but also from a policy perspective?
Well, it seems there's no doubt that it really works, and this is one of the biomedical interventions that has been proven to work, the other one being preventing mother-to-child transmission. through numerous clinical trials. I think done properly, I think it's a marvelous intervention. So much hinges on the done properly, because the consequences of male circumcision, in fact, to women, I think one has to anticipate what those might be and deal with them properly in the counseling up front, before the circumcision happens. But I think it's a logical and sensible investment, and I expect, you know, in an operational situation, we would see results. I would like to see, alongside of investments in male circumcision, equal and opposite investments in protecting young women and girls, explicitly some interventions which would be directed at the kinds of things that I've talked about. And then I think there would be a proper balance. The argument's always made to me that, well, we have no evidence that those things are going to work. And my answer to that is the investment's never been made. And that's why we don't have the evidence. I think if the investments are made, you will see dramatic effects from improved reproductive health for women and girls.
A lot of pressure, sorry. Karen Meacham, I'm with the Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS. Thank you for coming. This is a specific question. You said, I believe you said that at Anglo-American about 75% of people test regularly or at least come in. My question is, in this relatively supportive environment, it sounds like, who are the other 25% and what are their concerns? I mean, why are they not testing?
I actually believe it's because we don't do the job properly, because there are business units where they get right up into the 90s, and there are others that are actually hovering around the 75%. And I think you have to create the climate of mutual trust and respect. You have to create that foundation of rights, the non-discrimination, the confidentiality. You have to have the leadership, and if you get all those things right, you see the uptake coming. It's as simple as that.
That's a quick one. So, yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier in your speech that, you know, HIV is typically something you got from before, something that you live with and manage. And considering that and the fact that your company is providing this kind of antiretroviral something, how do you find that challenging?
I don't think it really comes up because, interestingly, you know, we have indicators of performance for our AIDS program, and the ones that we publish, which we believe are the two most important, are one, the take-up of HIV testing, and the other is the enrollment of HIV-positive people in programs of care and support. So we know our HIV prevalence within our workforce quite accurately now to be around 18%. That means in Southern Africa we have 14,000 employees who we think are HIV positive. Today, off the top of my head, there are about 8,000 of those employees that are enrolled. There are 6,000 that we've not identified and are not getting the care and support. That's where we focus our attention, and we say we find those people and get them the care. But it all happens through the HIV testing, and what I said before is when you have an HIV test, you enroll in the fight against AIDS, and that's either through prevention or treatment or both. So the distinction between them doesn't exist for me anymore.
I mean, here in D.C., there was some debate on whether, you know, advertisements that showed treatment makes it a chronic disease had kind of a young gay men were getting much more lax about condom use, for example. And if it's free and there are no, it's an ethical dilemma too, but you don't see any.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I have a long list of all the difficulties and consequences of providing access to treatment. And all I can say that, you know, whilst they're legitimate concerns, in reality, none of those have been realized to the extent that they've been a problem. That's the best way I could describe it.
I think we're at an end there. Before we conclude, it's corporate HIV week in Washington this week. On the 24th, on Wednesday, we have the Vice President of Health for Royal Dutch Shell coming, along with the Chair and CEO of FHI. And the Nigeria Country Director of FHI, who are in partnership working on HIV/AIDS in Nigeria. That's from 2 to 3:30 on Wednesday. So if anyone here is welcome to come, you can talk to Dave or me following if you want to get on the email for that. But mostly I want to thank you very much for a very comprehensive, thoughtful presentation here and for a great discussion from our audience. So thanks very much.